Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. Standard text rates apply. That's 087-179-1032. And we're going to start. Well, we have a special guest. We're just having a technical problem at the moment. So we will start. I will start then with what to see in the sky over the coming week. But we hope to get Kevin Nolan on the line. Kevin's been with us before once or twice on this program, an expert on all things space matters. He's a author and university lecturer in TU at Dublin. And we'll be talking about his upcoming lecture. It's on next week. It's called From Hubble to Webb. And it's going to be full of beautiful images. And it's a free lecture. And it's in UCD. And you'll be able to get information on that on, well, first of all, he's on Facebook. And also, it's been organized through the Irish Astronomical Society. So if you look at irishastrosoc.org, you'll get all the details there. Meanwhile, in the sky, we have the moon, which will set. It's up at the moment from our point of view here in Dublin, but will set in about half an hour's time before it rises again tomorrow at 10:23 a.m. in the morning. We're just past new moon. At the moment, we have a 13% waxing crescent moon. And as I say, it'll set in about half an hour's time before it rises again tomorrow morning at 10:23 a.m. It'll then be due south just after 5 p.m. tomorrow. And at that stage, it'll be a 20% waxing crescent and before it sets at just after 10 p.m. tomorrow evening as we head towards the first quarter moon on Saturday the 28th. Now, before we get to the planets and the sun, we do have Kevin Nolan on the line, I believe. No, he's gone again. So we go back. We're having some technical problems still, but we hope to get Kevin in a moment. Which leads us to sunrise tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday the 25th. It's at 20 minutes past 8, which is a whole 8 minutes earlier than a week ago. And then local noon at 12:37 p.m., which is 2 minutes later than a week ago. The sun will set just before 5 p.m., 4:54 p.m., to be precise. That's a whole 11 minutes later than a week ago. So we're getting to that grand stretch in the evenings for sure. And then from then until 5:33, we have civil twilight. And from then until 6:15, we have nautical twilight. And from then until just before 7 p.m., we have an astronomical twilight. And from then on, that's when nighttime officially begins. So all that means that we've 19 minutes more daylight than we had a week ago, another 3 minutes and 14 seconds between sunrise and sunset tomorrow, when there will be 8 hours and 33 minutes between sunrise and sunset. Now, before we get to the planets, we do have Kevin Nolan on the line, I believe. Good evening, hello. Kevin.
Yes. How are you, Ben?
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for joining us. Sorry about that. We had a few technical problems.
Pleasure.
But That's the joy of live radio, as we say. So, as I'm sure you're no stranger to it yourself. And yeah. We've had you on the program a few times before, talking about lots of things. I think Mars was the last one, yep. Your book, Cosmic Stepping Stones. you may have been on since then. But anyway, next week in UCD, there's a lecture organized by the Irish Astronomical Society. You're giving a talk called From Hubble to Webb. So perhaps you can go a little bit, tell us a little bit about what's coming up. We've seen the lovely pictures from Hubble and Webb, and I presume and hope you'll have some lovely, more lovely pictures in even finer detail.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of talks taking place about James Webb. I'm not involved in the project, so, you know, you might ask what do I have to contribute to it. I suppose the thing is that, like yourself, Ben, been interested in astronomy all my life, and we all find this a very, very exciting development in astronomy. And for about the last, 25, 30 years, we've had Hubble doing its thing, giving us extraordinary discoveries. And so I just thought it was appropriate, if we're going to do a talk about Webb to celebrate it, to take a look at its broader context and to take a look at, you know, what have been some of the seminal discoveries from the Hubble Space Telescope. And they basically lie along broad lines upon which Webb will then pick up on, such as Hubble gave us the age of the universe, at least we think we know how old it is from Hubble. It gave us our first view of nebulae and, you know, dusty disks around stars where planets may be forming, and then even detected some exoplanets. And it's just basically given us, I suppose, a perspective or a new paradigm shift in the way we look on the universe. And we've all been, those of us old enough to celebrate it, you know, have had the joy of Hubble over the last 25, 30 years. And now along comes Webb. And so the thing is that, you know, I suppose the first or the primary call is, you know, oh, it's infrared. Will we get nice pictures, you know? And from my own perspective, I just kind of thought, you know, maybe if I'm doing a talk to try and quench that apprehension and that fear, to celebrate James Webb as a telescope to show that it goes, not only will it deliver spectacular images, it will in fact go well, well beyond that. It actually will do basically the same kind of groundbreaking work that Hubble did all over again. And so we can look forward to 15 or 20 years of what we're hearing now of quite spectacular and groundbreaking discoveries from James Webb. It's already doing them, by the way. If we want to talk about some of the latest discoveries, it's active already, but it's barely getting going. Like, we hear it launched last year, and it's commissioned by July, and, well, it won't be actually fully commissioned until next September, but, you know, largely got up and running in by July, and then we kind of move on and say, great, we'll expect pretty pictures from it every so often. Well, no, it's only getting going. Scientists around the world literally right now are clamoring over one another to pitch for the best science in what's called an early science program, just to test what can Webb do, and then they're going to start the real work. So we're going to be anticipating extraordinary discoveries. In fact, well, when I say anticipating, we can anticipate the unexpected, that there are going to be discoveries we simply don't know yet, that we're going to get extraordinary surprises, both visually and scientific discovery-wise, that will, you know, take what Hubble did and bring it to the next level. And we're going to look at that in four, I won't go on too much longer for Ben before I get to get back in, but say there's four broad pillars that you're looking at. Trying to detect the very first stars to be born in the universe. So Webb is the first telescope specifically built to look back at the beginning of time, which is extraordinarily exciting. It's then going to look at the very beginning of the births of stars and planets, like literally as they take form inside nebulae, capture that moment, and doing some of that work as we speak. It will look at exoplanets and discover exoplanets in unprecedented numbers and detail and characterize their atmospheres and look for biomarkers. And then the one that surprised me in researching the talk is Webb is going to spend 7% of its time studying the solar system. And it's basically going to be do like what remote sensing satellites do on Earth in mapping, you know, the surface of Earth for, you know, forest fires and types of blight, maybe potato blight. It's going to use that kind of remote sensing capability and map the material makeup of our solar system in ways we haven't even been able to do with space probes. So it's going to look at Kuiper Belt objects and all of the icy moons and even Mars and follow trace gas changes and map the mineral makeup of the solar system in unprecedented detail. So it's picking up the gauntlet from Hubble. And so in this talk, which, by the way, will be very visual, spent a lot of time looking for the images, will, in particular, with three beautiful regions of the Milky Way, well, of space, the Pillars of Creation, the Carina Nebula in the Milky Way, and then actually the Tarantula Nebula in the Large Magellanic Cloud. We'll take a look at those images in beautiful detail from the ground, from Hubble, and then some of the ones from James Webb, and take a look at the comparative improvement, and not just improvement, but differences between Hubble and Webb, and how we'll gain unprecedented insight from both, in fact, Hubble and Webb working in tandem into the future. And as a pointer, just so people be able to go Google, in advance to talk. And this, again, as I say, took my breath away, and something I hadn't really contemplated until I started to put this talk together, was Hubble's put together a 29,000 pixel image of the Carina Nebula. And we'll look at that image in real detail and then dive into a small place, which we all know of now, from Jesus, called the Cosmic Cliffs. But the Hubble image is mind-blowing. You could spend a lifetime looking over this image. And we're going to look at these in beautiful detail, hopefully on a lovely projector system.
On a lovely big screen, I hope.
Yeah.
That's great. So, now, it's a very long time in gestation and making, and 10 billion euro there or thereabouts. And as you said, there'll be a lot of scientists looking for a spot of time on it to do their own work on it. But I know there is an Irish connection. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the Irish connection to
And, you know, I almost feel unqualified to mention it, but it's an honour to mention it, that the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, DIAS, as it's known, which is an institute set up by De Valera and others to bring Ernest Schrodinger over to Ireland during Second World War, and that research institute, which many people mightn't know of as well as they know the other universities, does dedicated research in cosmic studies and astrophysics, as well as Celtic studies and geophysics. And they've been deeply involved with the James Webb Space Telescope through Professor Tom Ray and Dr. Patrick Kavanagh. And they've been involved with four instruments on Webb. And for those of you who know the Hubble Space Telescope, the star of it is the Wide Field Planetary Camera. And the star imager on this, on Webb, is called NIRCam. But there's another extraordinary instrument, four instruments on Webb. And each instrument is a pinnacle of human achievement. They really are. And the one that the DIAS have been deeply involved with is called MIRI. And it's the coldest instrument ever sent into space. While Webb itself has been spending 6 months cooling itself down to just 50 Kelvin, or about minus 230, whatever, centigrade, MIRI is being cooled extra cold, just down to 7 Kelvin, 7 degrees above absolute zero. And so the philosophy behind Webb is, the colder it is, then the cooler things it can observe. Anything that's hotter than it will glow in infrared, and that's why we make James Webb so cold, to make it see anything that's even very cold by human standards, but warm by Webb standards, will glow. And so MIRI is a beautiful instrument because it'll see anything hotter than 7 Kelvin in the universe. And it's going to be the instrument that will clinch the discovery of the first stars to flare up and brighten up in the universe 13.6 billion years ago. And what DIAS did was they built all of the filters, because another side, if you think of, say, the three filters of red, green, and blue for a colour camera, and all that can reveal when you play around with your filters, like, Webb has something like 30 or 40 filters on board, so it can actually differentiate infrared colour with extraordinary detail, and DIAS provided those filters, as well as actually Dr. Patrick Evans has been involved actually in the commissioning of MIRI as an instrument and the development of the analysis software. So we have real, you know, engagement here. This is, you know, we Irish like to, don't we, boast about what we're connected with, and sometimes we can over-egg it a bit. There's no over-egging our involvement with James Webb. It's real, it's potent, it's live right now. They're very ingrained in the actual manipulation. Professor Tom Ray was significant in getting us involved in that through the last 10 or 12 years. And by the way, while everything else was late, or many other things are late, they delivered their filters on time and under budget before 2012. So our end of it was delivered with absolute, on time and under budget. Yeah.
So
great Irish involvement.
Yes, it's a great day for the Irish. Not just with Oscar nominations. That's all I've been hearing all day. But anyway, that's for a different program.
I like to say this a lot, Ben. I mean, like, you know, DIAS is a public body, so I mean, part of our taxes go into it. I mean, these telescopes aren't owned by scientists. You know, I think the thing I'd like to say for anybody listening is follow Webb, because the science it's going to release will be mind blowing, and it's about, you know, the big questions about where did the universe come from, where do planets come from, possibly where life comes from, or is there life elsewhere? These are big questions, and it's wonderful, amongst all the other hullabaloo of human politics that we get very caught up in, that we can do these wonderful projects that are really a celebration of society and what public money can do when we put it to good causes.
Thank you, Kevin. Now, one of course, the difference between Hubble and Webb, not just about the frequencies of yep. light that it measures, is Webb or Hubble is in a relatively low Earth orbit. I know it's elliptical orbit, but it's a maximum yep. of 600 kilometers out or thereabouts. I'm not exactly sure, but Webb is one and a half million kilometers yeah. away. And so can you tell us, like, why that is? Why would it not work in a, I presume yeah. it wouldn't work in a low Earth orbit.
Well, actually, as extraordinarily complex as the incident is and why it was 10 years late and $10 billion over budget, it would have been nowhere near ready still if we wanted to put it in Earth orbit. Because the thing is getting it down to that cold temperature and actually isolating it from seeing the Earth. So as we may know, it's got these tennis court-sized heat shields, five of them. And each of them are only a 20th of a millimeter thick, but they're 20 meters long and 40 meters wide. But those heat shields are basically pointing towards the Earth and the Sun, and then the Webb telescope is on the other side of it, never to see the Earth and never to see the Sun. And if the Webb telescope accidentally turned around and oriented itself towards the Sun, it would actually, basically burn out its instruments and it would never work again. So it has to maintain these unfathomably cold temperatures and try and remain as stable as that as it can. So what we've done is we discovered through, mechanics a long time ago, that there's a location about 1.5 million kilometers beyond the Earth where the Sun and the Earth's gravity broadly cancel each other out. And if you put something in there, it kind of stays in there. Now, it's not that stable a region, so it drifts off a little bit. But the thing is that little gravity, a black spot or empty spot, travels with the Earth around the Sun, so it stays with. So, we've put previous telescopes in there, like the Gaia Space Telescope, the European Space Agency one is in there as well, and we'll put others in there in the future. So when you put a telescope in that region, it broadly stays there. Now, the reason why Hubble we've had for 30 years and why we might only get 15 or 20 years out of Webb is it drifts, so we have to have thruster fuel on board to correct its orbit every so often. But the thing is that it's out there a million kilometers away to be well away from the Earth and the Moon. Never, it's little radio antennas pointing towards the Earth, but it's behind that heat shield at now an absolutely freezing temperature, and it will remain never to see the Earth or the Sun again, and that's the best place we can do it. It's called the Lagrange point, L2, four of them, I think, around the Earth, and basically this one is the one that's beyond the Earth, over by 1.5 million kilometers, and future space telescopes we put up there will probably go there as well.
No, Kevin, John here, good evening to you.
Yes.
We have a dedicated listener that sends in quite a number of emails week by week.
Sure.
One just said earlier on we needed talk from Kevin Nolan. So here we are. We've got you. Yep, that was jumping the gun. But one of the questions or statement he gave us last week just before the end of the program, is it true that the James Webb Telescope can read the heat signature of a bumblebee on the moon? So I'm just, would that be possible, you think?
The only thing I'll say is it wouldn't see something as small as a bumblebee.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of heat it emitted, probably. Because
mm-hmm.
yeah, because as I said, it can detect anything above 7 Kelvin. Now, it's very hard to explain how cold that is, and a bumblebee would glow literally like a star on the moon. The only question I have with that is, would we see it that small? Because here's the thing. In fact, I was discussing with this with somebody the other day. Even with the ELT, this big 40-meter telescope we're building in Chile, the question was, could it image the Apollo landing sites? And it won't be able. The smallest thing it'll see is around 10 meters wide, and the lunar module isn't quite that wide. So James Webb would probably only see something 30, 40 meters wide on the moon, if you know what I mean.
That's still pretty
now,
good.
The point is, however, what I will say to you is the amount of heat that a bumblebee emitted on the moon, yes, it would be able to pick that up.
Now, we've had the Hubble telescope doing its stuff on the optical side. The James Webb picks up, as you say, going back in time, way, way back into the beginning of the universe, or a little bit after as such, sort of 13 point whatever million. Mm-hmm. Now, a question that I'm asked very, very often, week by week by week, how, if we're here now in time, can we see back in time? So I know it's to do with waves, and it's the waves that sort of emitted before we get them sort of have to catch up with us. Would that be correct?
Well, okay. I often say, even when I'm asked this question in talks, like this is a further discussion well beyond the radio program.
Yes, yeah.
You know, all I can say is that, and this is the thing I suppose we can say is that light waves that were emitted, the universe is about 13.7 billion years ago, but was born around 13.7 billion years ago, so light that would have been emitted then took that length of time to get to us now. And the thing is space is empty between that place and here. Mm-hmm. That's how we see it. Now, the thing is, those galaxies will have moved on. In fact, we estimate that some of the galaxies we're seeing now around 13.5 billion years old may be as far as 36, 37 billion light years away now. Now, the light they're emitting now we can't see. But the light that they emitted 13 billion years ago, they had that amount of time in the universe for the light to get to us now. But there is, as has been conjectured, there are things we think maybe happened in the very earliest universe that we will never see because the light wouldn't quite reach us. But the thing, anyway, all I'll say is that anything that has had less than the age of the universe to send its light to us is catching up with us now, and we're seeing it. And so we're able to see that epoch. You know, but as I said, I know we can get to all sorts of discussions about the, you know, inflation, you know, the observable universe, where those galaxies are now. And I would just urge people not to go there unless you really want to spend an awful lot of time on it. Just accept that if something emitted light, say, 13.6 billion years ago, it had time to get the light to us.
Okay,
now.
So we won't talk about multiverses and parallel universes and things like that. That'll be another day's comment.
That's another program.
Next 2 minutes.
Yeah. So anyway, I hope that answers Alan's question. And yes,
probably
as we say,
by the way, but it's the best we can do, I think, now.
There are a lot of people out there, I think, who just can't get their head around it. No, you can.
Well,
I'm getting there.
I have to revise it every year, I promise you.
Yeah,
you know, but,
But it is hard. It's hard to believe that we're here now so many years ahead, and we're waiting for the light to come to us from so many billions of years ago. But that is another day's.
It's a beautiful thought, isn't it? That light.
Fantastic, yeah.
That travelled through all that time as well as, you know, space, in a sense, that if you want to put it that way, we're able to witness now. And I think that really, for me, is what, in researching the James Webb Space Telescope, is the most wonderful aspect of it. It is the first telescope. Now, every telescope looks back in time. Every amateur astronomer from the age of seven learns that. But this is the first one we put in space specifically to look back to the beginning of, you know, practical time, the first stars being born in the universe. That's amazing. And by the way, let's not take that discovery lightly. I would wager that discovering the first stars in the universe is a bigger discovery than, say, the Higgs boson, and will be a Nobel Prize winning discovery, by the way. So none of this is easy. It'll be a very big challenge to find the first stars in the universe. But won't it be a magnificent discovery to say we've spotted some of the first stars ever in the universe?
Well, I think just going back to that issue of light and travel, I think if you come back a bit and think of it from a more simple point of view, if you sent a pulse of light to someone on the moon, they would see it 1.5 or 1.25 seconds after you sent it. You just, the further out, the longer it takes.
Yes.
I always think of Einstein. He imagined riding on a light beam. I think that's where he got a lot of his ideas from, that type of thought experiments. But
well, you know, I say this in science classes to my students who do physics and maybe are a bit petrified for the first time. Einstein was a very visual person. You're right, Ben. He thought about this in a pictorial, visual way. So if you're interested in science and you've got a good imagination, that's a great place to start.
Excellent. We'll leave it there for the moment, Kevin. Thank you very much. I look forward to, I hope to, my get pleasure. To your talk next Monday in UCD. I know you get the details on irishastrosoc.org, and probably, I'm not sure, you have your own Facebook?
No,
or no, you don't?
It'll probably be on the IFAS Facebook page as well, and maybe IAS on Facebook as well.
Okay, that sounds good, and it is free, and there'll be lots of beautiful images, and
yes,
we look forward to it. And as I have said to you before, I love your passion for the subject. It is
a pleasure.
Infectious.
A pleasure,
thank you very much.
Cheers.
Kevin, we'll talk to
you
again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Kevin Nolan, of course, author and lecturer, as you know there, and he's the talk is next Monday in UCD. And if you look at Irish Astronomical Society or irishastrosoc.org, you'll get the details there. And Irish Astronomy Society also have a Facebook page.
And seeing as a wee like Mars as well, we might get him back at some stage to talk about his book, which is the cosmic a Cosmic Stepping Stone.
Cosmic Stepping Stone,
yeah,
which he says...
Because we love Mars.
We love Mars. Mm-hmm. And we should read... Actually, I was reading today that the Ingenuity helicopter made its 40th
yes, it
flight.
Did. Yeah, it did.
4-0.
Yeah, it's trying to decide where to go to next because it's a bit bumpy on the terrain. So it's the next beam back, I suppose, is just waiting for. Did we do the quick run of the planets?
We can do. We have a moment or two.
Yeah,
we can
just,
do the planet roundup for the week.
Left. Yeah, Mercury. It's having a nice dawn apparition at the moment, and it starts about 50 minutes before local sunrise. So it's still difficult to see, and its magnitude is just 0.0 all week. So. Venus, on the other hand, very bright at the moment, magnitude -3.9. It shines low in the west-southwest in the evening twilight, which is great to see it back in the evening skies, and it sets just after twilight at the moment. Saturn is on the way through and quite a little bit further down to Venus's lower right at the moment, quite difficult to see. Mars is in Taurus. It's very high at the moment towards the south in the early to mid-evening. A great sight to see. You will still see it quite well because it's that orange glow that you get. It's -0.6 and it's disappearing and getting dimmer down to 0.4 this week as well. Jupiter -2.2, another good sight. You can see it moving through the skies as the weeks go. So towards the western horizon, and it's going to just stay in the sky for a good while yet. Saturn, +0.8, difficult, and it passes brilliant Venus this week in the twilight southwest. Uranus and Neptune, very dim, -5.7 and 7.9, and they need really a telescope or a good pair of binoculars to see that. And what do you think of Buzz Aldrin getting married again?
Oh, yes, on his 93rd birthday. Yeah. He married his longtime girlfriend, a young woman of, she's reported to be 63 years of age or so. That's his fourth time for him to get married. The other three ended in divorce.
Yeah. Anyway, a note in from Alan there as well. Great speaker, guys. Thanks for Kevin and for joining us on the program this evening, and Alan agrees, yep, the heat signature only, rather than the bumblebee.
Actually, the bumblebee itself, yes.
So I'm glad we got that as well. So, blushing Alan in cloudy Kildare.
Cloudy Dublin. And if you miss next week's talk, there is a good chance, although it's not confirmed yet, that Kevin will be doing that talk again during Astronomy Week, which is at the end of March, that's organised by, for the most part, by Ronan Newman, whom we had in this programme a few weeks ago, and he will be giving it, we hope, most likely, in the campus, the TU Dublin campus in Grange Gorman, but I think we're out of time
now. Did you catch a glimpse of the moon this evening?
Not
very, very. I meant to have a look last night, I couldn't see it.
13% present.
Yeah, it's fantastic to watch it at that stage. Okay. Just through the clouds. We had a slightly clearer evening up here, but that's it. So anyway, that's about it then for this evening.
Thank you, John. And don't forget our email address. You can write to us anytime. astronomy@dublincityofm.ie is the email address. Thanks to John for his news items too, and for driving the sound desk this evening, and to the people who put this show up as a podcast, including people like James Sweeney and Conor Lennon. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Hello China, 9 o'clock. It's Threads with Bren Linnett. 11 p.m., we have Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood. And from midnight to 2 a.m., we have After Hours with Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul. Please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. Say goodnight, John.
Say goodnight, John. Good night. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.